Dear listeners, Sairam and greetings from Prashant Nilayam. Welcome to our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai at 12:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 29th October 2015. Have a listen, please.
Salam, dear listeners. Welcome to this week's Afternoon Satsang. With humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. We begin this week's Afternoon Satsang. We've taken a topic, I'm not too sure if we are really qualified to speak on it, but just as learners, along with all of you, we're going to explore this topic. It's a very, very esoteric theme which we are trying to dwell with, but it's completely based on a very, very beautiful and phenomenal chanting which we might have heard many, many times in Swami's presence in the mandir. It is chanted many times during the Vedam chants in the mandir. So before I tell you what it is and go into much detail, let me invite Arvind to join the discussion. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem. And as you rightly said, the discussion that we have taken up today is something that each one of us will be going through at some point of time in our lives or the other. That is for certain, because what we'll be going through is nothing but the spiritual evolution. You know, there are different kinds of evolution that is going on. There's an evolution in matter, then there's the evolution in life. Sadly, a lot of emphasis in modern science, not modern science actually, in science had been on the evolution in material and the evolution in life. The spiritual evolution had been neglected. Yes, of late, even modern science is waking up to concepts like consciousness, being conscious, and all these things which cannot be so strongly experimentally proved, but still arouse great deal of interest. This shows the magnificence of our ancestors, the people of the Bharatiya culture, who realized that of the three aspects, MBA, mind, body, atma, the A is so important. Recently during Dasara, we had these discourses where Swami said that the complex of the mind, body, atma is each being. If the body reigns supreme, controlling the mind and atma according to what it is. I mean, if we give importance to body over mind and atma, then Swami said you become like an animal, doing everything to fulfill only bodily needs. And then Swami says in the discourse that if you give priority to the mind over body and atma, then you become a clever devil, you become a rakshasa, where mind is reigning supreme. If you want to be a true manava, in the sense, in the way you were intended to be, that is, man is supposed to be a spark of the divine. Swami says, if you have to be manava, atma has to be given the top priority or importance. So today, while material evolution could be taken as a bodily thing, and the evolution of life, we have seen how life has evolved from a single-celled being to human beings that we have today. Unicellular creatures, unicellular organisms to human beings that we see today, that is the evolution of life. That could be taken possibly as the mind, because man dominates over the world surely because of his dominant mind. But the most important evolution is not the evolution of matter nor the evolution of life, but the evolution which is spiritual in nature. That evolution does not stop with Homo sapiens. You know, we often feel that life is greater than inert matter. So we take life as a significant evolutionary step, a quantum leap from inert matter. And in life itself, as I said, man is the ultimate. But man is not the end all of evolution, because in spiritual evolutionary terms, man is the starting point. A human life is a starting point. And so today in this satsang, with Bhagwan's grace, with Bhagwan's immense blessings, and totally his inspiration, we try to take up this third important evolution, the spiritual evolution, which is something that we all have to embark upon, having completed the physical evolution and the evolution of life. Because we have life, we have completed physical evolution. And because we are born as Homo sapiens, as human beings, we are more or less complete on the evolution of life. So as we begin our spiritual evolution, this would be a good topic to take up, because learning the basis of everything, what is the basis of this entire creation, is going to be the starting point and possibly the culminating point also in this spiritual evolutionary process.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the difference of approach from these great seers, whom we refer to as the ones who have given us the Vedantic philosophy, the sages and the saints, and that of the scientific minds, you know, there is one basic difference between their approaches: the humility with which the sages and the seers approach the matter. You know, from the very beginning, the idea was, with this mind, I cannot comprehend it. But they believe that in the process of comprehension, what can be gained is immense. No, you might never be able to know the truth, but in trying to know the truth, the amount of growth and the evolution which you spoke of, which one can achieve, can be really immense, which you cannot do if you only concentrate on the material. You know, very often people, whenever there's the discussion of existence of God or not, it's a very absurd argument that how can you believe in what you cannot see? Well, if that's the case, we cannot believe in half the things we believe in science, because we don't see any of those things, especially if you talk about astronomy, cosmology. I mean, we have not seen any of it. We've not seen 90% of what we have come to believe as people who subscribe to scientific thought. But what these people said was, like, you know, let us look at life very, very critically. We cannot be what we are just seeing each other as. I'm seeing you as a body. We cannot be like that. What happens after death? What happens before birth? You know, what are all these memories we are still carrying? You know, when there is a situation, there are two brothers who react so differently. Where is that culture coming from, even before you go through a culture, you know, in your childhood, in your adolescence? Where is that sense of, you know, something which is compelling you to choose something over the other? Where is that coming from? Why is one person different from the other? Why is it that some people are good? Why is it some people are bad? You know, these are the questions which were really keenly thought about, with the idea that probably we'll never be able to understand it. You know, probably we'll never be able to know the truth, because that is an overbearing thing. In fact, one of the pivotal statements in the Upanishads is Yato Vacho Nivartante Apraapya Manasasaha, which means that truth exists in that place where mind and speech return defeated when they try to understand and explain it. You know, first and foremost, this is the thought which is given to the student and told that now you try to understand what that truth is, what that basis is to life.
Beautiful, because as it is said, Vidya Dadati Vinayam.
Right.
The process of trying to acquire knowledge itself will confer humility. You were saying about how so-called scientific thinking is supposed to be that if you cannot see it, you can't believe it. And when you say that in science also, there are many things we can't see, the explanation given is that you may not be able to see it with your naked eyes, but there are instruments. There are instruments that modern science has developed that can perceive, that can see these things. And because those instruments see those things, you are able to perceive their existence. You may not be able to see X-rays, but there are machines which can detect X-rays, and therefore you are able to perceive X-rays. So science states back that though you are not able to see everything, there are ways to develop instrumentation which will help you to perceive these. In the spiritual field also, there are instruments which help us to perceive. You know, that is why this famous quote goes that you may not see God, but you can feel him or feel her or feel it, however we choose to define God. But this shows that there are ways to perceive God or perceive all these things, though you cannot see it. The only thing is, while science depends on tools and instruments that are external, in the case of the spiritual journey, it's always an inward journey. You know, that is why even Swami, while defining a term like education, he said the actual term should be educare. And educare is derived from a
Latin
word. A Latin word which means to elicit or bring out. And Swami says that when that word is having a root which means to bring out, how can education be all about stuffing what is outside into the person's head? Since its root word is to elicit or to bring out, educare is actually the process by which you elicit whatever exists within a person, because whether you believe it or not, all that a person needs to know, already exists within. The journey is journey inward. That is the difference possibly in the external approach and the internal approach, the spiritual approach and the scientific approach. While one is a journey outwards, taking you to the moon, to the farthest planets, to the farthest galaxies, the other makes you discover your inner space, the inside, which leads to the next evolution. While definitely the first two evolutions culminated with movement into the farthermost extremities of space, the next evolution has to begin in traveling into the internal space. And that is exactly what is described in this part of the Taittiriya Upanishad that we plan to take up today. Prem, you had said that you will be introducing it later. I am taking that baton from you.
Sure.
We will be doing this entire discussion based on the Bhruguvalli. A Bhruguvalli is actually an interaction between Bhrugu and his father Varuna, who is also his guru. So Bhrugu is keen to know what is the basis of everything. He is filled with the kind of questions, curiosity and intensity what we described so far, to know about the actual spiritual evolution and find an answer to so many of these questions. The beautiful thing about spiritual evolution is it can't be acquired or conferred upon by someone. It has to be a self-effort which results in something. You know, it's like building your muscles. Nobody can build your muscles for you. You have to put in the effort and do the exercise. So too, when you want to build up your spiritual evolution, it is an effort that the individual has to put. And knowing this, the father and guru Varuna sends his son Bhrugu and directs and helps him shape his effort so that Bhrugu evolves to a level where he finally realizes what is the basis for everything.
No, whenever we talk about this concept of all the knowledge is within and we just have to bring it out from within, I think Swami has himself spoken about this many times. I think apparently during one of the summer course on which Swami spoke a lot about Vedanta, Swami started quoting verbatim from some of the Upanishads, which was surprising then. We expect that out of Swami in a sense. But that time the many scholars who were there, who just came because Swami was running a summer course, was surprised to see that, you know, here is this Swami who has never been to formal schooling, he's never been a student to any great pandit, and he's quoting like this. And best part was, Swami started quoting and Swami started giving commentary on some Upanishads. And then Swami started comparing it with Western thought. You know, he started telling that this philosopher said this, and he started naming modern philosophers, and he started defining some of the concepts in philosophy in Western culture and equating it with the Indian philosophy. And people were really surprised with the authority with which Swami was doing that. And apparently at the end of it, none less than Professor Gokak went and asked Swami. He said, Swami, when did you read all this? He said, when did you read all this? How did you happen to know so much, Swami? He said. And the answer which Swami gave was very, very cute. Swami said, I don't have the bad habit of reading books. That's what Swami said. And Swami told him a very profound point. He said, see, this is not any divine ability. The human brain itself is so complex and so able that it actually has the ability to access all knowledge. And if you are able to train yourself to access one particular part of the brain, you can actually get information about any field of knowledge, any field of art, anything. The mind has the ability for that. It really sounds fascinating, but partly we actually experience it even in technology sometimes. You have something called a simple SIM card, right? And you have the right instrument. If you put it in the phone, you are having access to the internet, which is like a world of knowledge, right?
Exactly.
It's actually just a SIM card. It's just a small piece of plastic or with a little bit of metal in it. But with that, you can access immense knowledge you cannot believe can be stored in such a small size. But it is only a medium which allows you to connect to that knowledge. So it's almost like that. The human brain is something like that. It is like, how much can you sit and get those settings right so that, you go from just making a voice call to SMS, and from there you're able to go to 3G and, get that internet speeds. Are you able to get that settings right? It's almost like this particular Upanishad we're talking about. Bhrugu comes and asks his father that, I want to know this knowledge. And he does not give him any answer, except for the first hint which he gives. We'll go into the details after this. Just gives him a hint and he says, now you start exploring on your own. And it is almost like Bhrugu goes back and works on those settings. And every time he comes and says, you've got it, part of it is right, but work little more, you'll get little more, you can go deeper into the wisdom. It's almost like that, Bhrugu goes back and he comes back every time and he comes with a more profound understanding.
When you were mentioning about those cell phones, it's almost like Bhrugu is a smartphone who comes to his father.
Who's being used only for...
making calls. When he asks, where do I get this knowledge? What is the basis of everything? And the father tells, look within. The smartphone has everything built inside, has the browsers, has the ability to connect, has the signal. So it might happen that a mobile phone, even though it's a smartphone, however smart it may be, if there is no network connectivity, right, it's lost. It's as good as a piece of brick when it comes to searching for knowledge.
And you have everything there. You have the SIM, you have the smartphone, you have the internet.
Yes, but there's no connectivity.
No connectivity.
So this connectivity is what in spiritual parlance we call as sadhana. So what father actually tells is, you know, the Bhruguvali starts, Bhrugur Vaivarunihi Varunam Pitaram Upasasara. When he asks his father, what is Brahman? Because, you know, at least the theoretical answer that we know is Brahman is the basis of everything. Brahman or God or consciousness or spirit, energy, whatever we call, whatever, however we choose to term it. We know that that is the basis of everything. And so he now says, okay, dad, I know Brahman is the basis of everything, but what is this Brahman? What is Brahman? And the father says, Brahman is everything. It is what makes you see, it is what is seen, it is what makes you hear, it is the basis for everything. Okay, father, that is still good academic explanation, but what is that Brahman? What is that Brahman that makes me see? What is it that is the basis for me to hear? What is it that is the basis for me to feel? What is it that is the basis for everything? You are defining the characteristics of Brahman, but what is Brahman? And that is when father says that, oh, smartphone, you have the SIM card, the internet exists there, you need connectivity. That is exactly what Varuna tells to his son Bhrugu. He says, go and achieve that connect. I mean, he doesn't say go and achieve the connect. He says, go do tapas. And that is how, if you see the Bhruguvalli, every stanza in every Anuvaka, it ends with satapo tapyata satapas taptva. Which we will see this happening, that every time Bhrugu does penance, he comes up with an answer. He comes and tells his father that, I think this is the answer. Father says, you know, good, but not good enough. Find out more. So he sends him back to penance, back to again more penance. So throughout, it is this connectivity that is important. And in the spiritual parlance, this connectivity we can achieve by daily regular sadhana and tapas. So when Bhrugu has asked Varuna what it is, Varuna tells him, go do tapas, go do penance. Seek within, you will get the answer. And that is how Bhrugu sets out to do penance in order to find out what is the basis of everything in the universe.
One thing which needs to be told about Upanishads in general. In Sanatan Dharma, there are many types of scriptures. You have Bhagavad Gita as a scripture. You have Mahabharata and Ramayana, which is a scripture. And you have these Upanishads and Vedanta, you know, the texts which form the Vedic wisdom. These are all actually scriptures. But there is a basic difference between what we call as, you know, Puranas or Itihasas and Vedanta. If you see, it's the same truth. The way Swami puts it, he says that, you know, when we speak about Ramayana, we say that so many times. We played that clip where Swami says that Ramayana is the essence of the Vedas. It's almost like the entire Vedas and the Vedic wisdom enacted in a drama form is Ramayana. And a little more elaborate is the Mahabharata. So it's really the same wisdom which is enacted. So when you see it in the Mahabharata, if you see it as a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, or Uddhava coming and asking Krishna, you know, here is a worldly person, an aspirant nevertheless, but a worldly person comes and asks, you know, I'm not able to understand this concept. So you will have a story introduced. You know, the guru will tell a story. You know, a very cryptic message is given. And there'll be an elaborate, if you see Tripura Rahasya and all that, I think for explaining each sentence, there'll be 4 or 5 stories. You know, same thing is the case with the dialogue between Rama and Vasishtha. Right? Yoga Vasishtha. It's filled with stories. But in the Upanishad, if you see, especially this is a classic example of that. The disciple goes and asks a very direct question to the guru. He does not do any beating around the bush. You know, he does not say that the world is so different and why people suffer. There is nothing like that. Go straight and ask, what's Brahman? See, that's the last stage of any aspirant. The last knowledge somebody gains. He goes and asks straight for that because he knows, you know, the disciple has crossed the stage of, you know, the lows and highs of life, the material life and family life. He has understood that what we really seek is not in any of these. So he comes and asks for a direct question. And the guru's response is also quite direct. He does not tell stories. In fact, the first thing which Varuna says here is so important. He says, Brahman is that which is always there. It never came, it never went. Everything else that comes and goes in this. And it's almost like he says, it's like an ocean, the waves rise and fall. The ocean is always there. Waves change their shapes, waves come and go. They have a limited existence, but this does not come and go. So that's almost like the hint which he gives. So go and find out that which never comes and goes.
And when you say that he gives a hint, He's giving it not because he doesn't want to reveal the answer. It is because the answer, as I said, cannot be revealed.
Right.
It has to be experienced, and if it is revealed also, it will not make sense. We can ourselves see this happening in our lives, you know. I have personally seen, Swami has spoken about so many things. One small example where Swami speaks about Sachidananda. He says, Sat is being, Chit is awareness. Sat being is like water, and Chit awareness is like sugar. When you mix these two, you get sugar syrup. You get syrup. That syrup is sweet. That is bliss. That is Ananda. This is Sachidananda. You know what? In my grade 11, 1999, I knew this. In fact, I wrote this answer in my human values paper and I got full marks for it. 4.5 out of 5 or whatever. Because it was a very complete, comprehensive answer that I had written. But it is only recently, you know, Prem, I got goosebumps on my skin. I had my hair standing up on their ends and I felt a kind of thrill when, at least I feel I understood better than what I understood then, the meaning of this sugar water analogy or example. And you know, now when I explain it, it is not as if in my words there will be any difference. There was no difference in the words. That is why even in that time and age, I got full 5 out of 5. But you know what? If I have to speak about this one analogy, I feel now I can do so for about 30 minutes because I feel so many sparks of inspiration from that. So I feel that is how our spiritual evolution also happens. You know, the answer is very simple and maybe encapsulated in a few words, a few sentences maybe. But it'll make no meaning at all unless we ourselves, through our effort, grow to a level where we are able to receive it and feel the inspiration from it. So at that point in time, if Varuna had told Bhrigu that, hey, you know what, the answer, Brahman, I'll tell you the answer. Because towards the end of our discussion, we'll come to the answer. And that time we will realize that if in the beginning, the father had said, you know, this is the answer, it would not have made almost any difference to Bhrigu. You have to work your way through the answer and get the answer. It's almost like in the maths problem, many times, if your answer is wrong, but you've worked it out correctly, you get 4 out of 5. If everything you're working is wrong, but you've got your answer perfectly right, the teacher still gives you 0. Because it's not about hitting the answer. It's about how you're working out towards the answer. Because once your working ability becomes correct, someday or the other, sometime or the other, you're going to hit the answer. But if your working is wrong and simply you're fluking or, you know, you're hitting the answer by chance, you know nothing in mathematics. That is, I think, one commonality between mathematics and spiritual.
It's like we undergo that in everyday life, but I mean, we don't look at it very keenly. I mean, if getting the answer right is all that matters, then I think no recruitments will have interview as a process of recruitment. They'll just go by the marks that you've got.
Correct.
You know, you got 90, okay, you stand in the 90s percentage. You got an 80 or a 70, you fall in that category. Why is that even after seeing the marks, you have an interview, you have a group discussion? It is to see whether you've got the marks, but have you got the marks with the understanding? Because you're valued only based on how much you've understood the concept. And it's the same thing here. It comes with that understanding. And I think we might have said the story before once. We had a story on our website. You know, there is this man who's a philosopher who speaks about various high and deep philosophies and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not at peace with himself. Because he feels that he has not really, you know, felt that ecstasy and the joy which you are supposed to feel when you've seen the oneness. Like theoretically, he knows that, you know, there is everything is one.
A classic case of most of us.
Right, most of us. But he keeps on saying, I'm not feeling that, you know, ecstasy which I speak so much about.
Hmm.
But, you know, he's already got such a huge following and he cannot reveal this to anybody. So what he does is he just takes a break and he goes away and he goes into the forest and in search of a master. You know, and goes to the master's presence. And then he says, yeah, I'm very famous like this. I speak, I've read so many books, I've given so many lectures, but I've never felt that ecstasy myself. Then the master asks him a very, very cryptic question. He says, how have you read these scriptures? Have you read these scriptures like a rich philanthropic man who does charity of sandalwood? Or have you read them like a princess who admires herself in front of a mirror?
Hmm.
Okay, and he says, like, what's the difference? So apparently we always think the charity and philanthropy is supposed to be higher than narcissism, you know? You sit in front
narcissism.
Of the mirror. Narcissism, where you sit in front of the mirror and admire yourself. So, but he keeps quiet and then the master explains, let's see, you have done it like a philanthropist who does charity of sandalwood. He says, a guy who does charity like that, lifts sandalwood and gives it to somebody. In the process, a little bit of the fragrance will stick in his hand, but after some time it fades away.
Hmm.
It still comes from outside, so it'll go away. But a princess, when she's sitting in front of the mirror, she's admiring the image which is there in the mirror, all the while knowing that it's her own image. He says when you come to an understanding and then read scriptures and then read some of these deep philosophy, you are actually resonating with what is being said in that book. It is almost like you're looking at a mirror. You know that it is in you and you're looking at it and you're admiring.
Mm.
And then that is the best way you actually have to read these scriptures. And that's when you will really enjoy it.
And so I think that is quite some discussion on how it is important that we ourselves dwell and make these efforts. So that is what actually Bhrigu has set out for. You know, he has set out to make efforts and in his father's words, to do penance. What is the result of Bhrigu's penance? What is the answer that he gets, which excites him so much that he comes rushing back to his father to say that, Dad, I found the answer. That I think we shall take up after this break. So dear listeners, don't go anywhere. The most interesting part of the discussion is coming up. We'll take this little break, on the other side of which we will continue with what was Bhrigu's first discovery.
Yam Brahma Varunendra Rudra Marutaha Stunvanti Divestavai Vedai साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्तं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः सत्यं ज्ञानमनन्तं ब्रह्म
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 सत्यं
That, dear listeners, was a famous bhajan which you have heard many times, which you have followed. But interestingly, I think in the Upanishad Vaini, where Swami speaks about the Taittiriya Upanishad, Swami says that this particular appellation for Brahman, you know, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, actually is from this Upanishad, from where Bhrigavali is, the Taittiriya Upanishad. This is the first Upanishad where Brahman is described like this. That which is Satyam, which is truth, Jnanam, which is wisdom, and Anantam, which is endless. Only that which has these as its qualities can be called as Brahman, as the true eternal Brahman.
Wow. In fact, this is precisely what Varuna briefly tells Bhrigu before Bhrigu embarks on his journey. And so now, you know, having done tapas, Bhrigu gets the insight. You know, we had spoken about this in, I think, when it came to the 9-point code of conduct as to how do we get jnana or this insight or wisdom, jnanodaya as they call it, that is the dawn of wisdom. It makes us feel that if the ultimate goal of human life is the discovery of Brahman, that is what it is, then what is the need for, you know, what we do day to day, that is seva or bhakti, bhajan, and we resolved this using Swami's analogy of the clock. I think it's apt to just recollect it once because there'll be so much emphasis on Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam, which is listening, then contemplating on it and finding the answer within, that we might have the danger of neglecting bhakti and karma, that is effort, seva, and thinking why is all that needed, because ultimately the end goal of life is to discover the reality within. Swami had said that in a clock, if you see, there are three hands. One is the minute hand, one is the second hand, one is the hour hand. The second hand is the one that moves constantly. Then the next is the minute hand. The hour hand moves very slowly. And you know, the time is judged by the hour hand. You want to know whether it's 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. You will be happy to know whether it's 3 o'clock or 3:30 or 3:45. That makes a little difference. But you know, apparently you are not at all bothered about whether it is 3:30, 42 seconds or 3:30, 51 seconds. The second's hand is almost meaningless. Nobody asks the position of the second hand at all. But then Swami says, if the second hand doesn't move, the minute hand will not move. And if the minute hand doesn't move, the hour hand doesn't move. And that second hand is like karma yoga, is like karma, actions. Do a lot of good actions, then you get good feelings or bhakti, which is the minute hand. A lot of good feelings, or that is bhakti, leads to some amount of insight or jnana, which is the hour hand. So though we are judged by the jnana, in order to imbibe that jnana, it is very important that we have karma and bhakti. Because I'm saying this when I was reading about the Bhrigavalli, there are many commentaries, many explanations. In a few of them, tapas, you know how tapas has been defined? Tapas is not given as penance.
Mm-hmm.
Tapas is being defined as devotion. And the father is telling Bhrigu, go and indulge in devotion. Then you will get the answer. So in some places, it's being interpreted as intense activity, which is karma. In some places, it is being interpreted as devotion or bhakti. So when I was reading that, it struck me that this is what Swami has tied together. That when you say tapas, it does not mean just sitting in one place, listening to a discourse, or just reading a book, or also just going and serving the people. It is a combination of karma and bhakti which gives jnana. So tapas, we have to keep in mind that when Bhrigu's father has told him to go and do tapas, what Bhrigu did is not described in the Bhrigavalli. They don't say what Bhrigu did, they just say that Bhrigu did tapas. So that tapas involves all these three, which is intense study, Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam, which is also seva, karma, action, which is also bhakti, devotion. So in future also, dear listeners, when we will be referring to the word tapas, we are not referring to sitting just cross-legged or something. We are referring to a combination of bhakti, karma and jnana. And that is what Bhrigu does and comes running back to his father.
Right, but you know, that's why it's important, even when you're studying the Bhrigavalli, it's important to see the Upanishad as a whole, the Taittiriya Upanishad. Swami's Vahini, Swami does not speak only about the Bhrigavalli, he speaks about the Taittiriya Upanishad, of which Bhrigavalli is almost like the practical lesson of the entire Upanishad. And the other two Valli is nothing but sections of that Upanishad, you know. The first one is Sikshavalli, Anandavalli and Bhrigavalli. These are the three important components of the Taittiriya Upanishad. In fact, Swami makes this point in the beginning of that commentary on Taittiriya Upanishad. He says, Sikshavalli is all about karma. Shikshavali, the student is told, respect your parents. You know, the famous lines of Matra Devo Bhava, Pitra Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Atithi Devo.
The convocation mantra.
Right, that is from this part. The Shikshavali is from Taittiriya Upanishad. So, Swami says that when you have performed all these roles properly, when you have performed your karma properly in the station of life you are in, after you have, you know, excelled in this idea of devotion. Here, of course, you know, it's always concentrating more on the aspect of Vedic learning, like your devotion to the learning of the Vedic mantras. But you can generalize it too, where Swami says, when you are performing these things perfectly, you know, when you talk, that's why we said Upanishad is about a student who has achieved a certain amount of understanding with his own effort who comes and asks these questions. Swami says, when you have led a life of idealism this way, you will reach Swarajya. You know, that's the word Swami uses. You will have total control over yourself. Without that, you cannot go into tapas. You know, even if it is sitting cross-legged or indulging in any other kind of contemplation, it cannot be done if you have not attained this total control over yourself. And that can be attained only through karma, upasana and all these other things.
So now that is very clear. We have also defined in a way what tapas means. Tapas is a combination of all this, achieving self-control, doing our actions, doing our duties and responsibilities to perfection, doing seva, service, engaging in devotion, bhakti. So all this. And yes, of course, study of literature. You know, for us, it'll mean listening to Bhagwan's discourses, studying the literature that he has left behind, a vast literature for us, the Vahinis, Satisai speaks. So all this comes under the umbrella of tapas. So having done tapas, Bhrigu comes running to his father and says, Father, here's the answer. And father says, what is the answer? I think before we dwell on it, maybe we can listen to the chanting of the Bhriguvalli, where Bhrigu is giving the answer to Varuna.
Annam brahmeti vyajanat, annat jeva khalvimani bhutani jayante, annena jatani jivanti, annam prayanta visam visamti te. Tad vijnaya punareva varunam pitaram upasasara.
As you would have heard in this chant, the term that keeps repeating is annam. Annam means food. And Bhrigu, in his penance, in his tapas, he realizes that food is the basis for everything. He comes and tells his father, Father, you know, everything that is born out of food. Everything that is sustained by food. And finally, when anything is destroyed, it becomes food. We see that. We become food either to other animals, to microorganisms. If not anything, we become manure for the trees and plants. So from food is something born, and food is what sustains it, and food is what destroys it. In a definition of God, I remember on many occasions, Bhagwan has elaborated G-O-D as G is generator, one who creates. O is organizer, one who preserves what has been generated. And D is destroyer, one who destroys. So anything that gives birth, sustains and destroys is God. That is how Swami has defined God. And so Bhrigu feels that things are born out of food, born from food, they're sustained by food, and finally they become food, they're destroyed into food. And therefore, this is the basis for the entire creation. And therefore, annam, food is divine, annam brahma. That is the first discovery that Bhrigu makes, and with excitement comes to his father and says, Father, I know Brahman, annam brahma.
Right, but you know, before we jump into conclusions that Bhrigu returned a foodie, you know, there's a very, very important difference between, you know, a misconception such as that. Because here he's talking about worshipping food, you know, a kind of a mad reverence for food. Because you suddenly realize it's not just what is lying on your plate. It is something which sustains you and something which really makes you. You know, that is the very, very deep thought he's coming with. And this would not have come by just sitting. This has come from real keen observation of your thoughts, real keen observation of people around you, you know, what they eat, what has resulted, you know, all those kind of things has been observed. And he comes and says, food is playing such an important role in our life.
And this is a very, very, very important point, Prem, what you made. Because when we say food, we might think of, you know, possibly burgers and rasam rice and curd rice. But that is not. Here, food is a generic term to determine to denote the material world.
Right.
Because, you know, everything is food for something or the other. You know, the wood of the tree is food. There are some creatures. There is the dung beetle which eats dung.
Right.
So food just does not mean what we cook and think as food. food is a annam here is referring to the material world. And it's almost like Bhrigu coming and telling that, you know, that the entire creation as we see is made up of material. So material must be Brahman. So that is the deeper significance of Annam Brahma. And as you said, it's not that he returned a foodie thinking that I have done penance, I've not had anything to eat, so food is God for me now.
Exactly. As I said, you know, many times you've heard Swami saying this, you know, Annam Brahma is, of course, we've heard Swami himself say. It's not just Bhrigu's conclusion. Swami would tell us, you know, why we should not eat food when you're talking about the regular food which we refer to. Swami would often say Annam Brahma, never waste that. But also Swami would tell that, I remember one of our lecturers were telling, you know, he was saying that when he was a student, he was constantly asking himself, what is that one lesson or one teaching of Swami that I can really follow? You know, Swami's teachings are so complex. Probably I should pick something which is very simple and I should, you know, hold on to it and follow it. So he really, you know, went through so much of Swami's literature looking for a simple dictum of Swami which he could follow. And he thought, this thing which Swami says, don't waste food, that seems like a very simple thing to follow, you know. I mean, it just needs a little bit of self-control in while having serving. The food served, right? More than anything else. So he said, all right, let me do this. I'll follow this thing of don't waste food. And few months into this sadhana of his, Swami gives a discourse. And in the discourse, Swami mentions this very point. You know, you should not waste food and all that. And then Swami says, what is food? Anything that goes into the human body by way of the senses is food. So what you see, what you hear, what you read, what you intake, what you, you know, converse with people, the knowledge that you take from outside, the influences that you take from outside, all this is food. You should not waste any of that. You know, the one sentence... Swami makes this concept of food so profound. So, you know, it's almost like that kind of a concept which Bhrigu comes back and says, food is everything. Because everything seems to be food. Everything seems to be changing. You know, food is becoming that thing which is controlling my actions. Food is becoming something which is controlling my way of thinking and my way of choices.
So when we say the term annam, it definitely is a very vast and expansive term. It is like a universal superset of which food that we use in day-to-day term is also a subset. So when we say Annam Brahma, it definitely refers to the table, the mic, the wood, the tree, the animal, everything being God. But it also refers to the rice, rasam, the curd rice, the bread, the vegetables, the fruits that I eat also as food. So it is not mutually exclusive. Just because we are specific, we are not excluding the general. Just because we are general, it is not as if it doesn't apply to the specific. I feel we should dwell a little time on the specific because Swami spent a lot of time. You know, even when Swami used to speak about the Sealing on Desires program, he would say, do not waste. And one of the things, the most important was, do not waste food. Swami has always said, it is so important. You know, what Bhrigu arrived at as a conclusion is so true. When we look at a pregnant lady and as the fetus develops in the womb and 9 months later it is delivered as a baby, what we are seeing is a miracle that even modern science has not been able to achieve. Though it understands all the reactions, what is happening, when it happens, where it happens, how it happens, why it happens, they can't say, they can't explain, and because of that they are just not able to recreate that process. And how is that baby being created? That baby is being created from the food that the mother eats. Absolutely. You know, we have mothers eating leaves. Okay, of course, there are some vitamins, these that everyone must take. But the variety, you look at it, people in deserts eat something, people in ice-capped regions eat something, and yet the baby comes out the same. There's a miracle taking place where exactly those nutrients and are absorbed and built into this baby. It is amazing. And it is not as if they're eating the same things. That is the miracle that science is not able to do, that only God can do. And therefore, it is very, very logical to conclude that food is God, because it is food that is creating this life. And then once the baby is born, what makes it grow? A baby which is hardly 1 foot in length grows to 6 feet. Sometimes some of the people have grown to 8 feet. Such height, such strength, such weight, only through food, nothing else. And finally, when it dies, becomes food, as we said. So it is very logical that Bhrigu concludes that this miracle can be done only by God, and this miracle is being done by food, therefore food is God. So it's a very logical conclusion that food is revered like that, and therefore I feel we should spend some time in seeing how food is God, because food is so important. Swami says, food do, blood do, head do. He would talk of these three terms. He would say, the quality of food determines quality of your blood, and the quality of the blood determines the quality of your head. So while food quality determining blood quality is a scientifically verifiable fact, Swami, you're speaking at a subtle level also. It's not just the nutrients and chemical pesticides of the food. The food that we eat contains other nutrients at subtle levels, which also travel through your blood to reach your head and determine your thoughts and your future and so many things. And therefore, it is so important, the food that we eat.
Very true. You know, before we come to that detail, because automatically when you bring in that concept, you're talking about how do you purify the food that you take in. But again, taking it back to the idea that food is just not what is on your plate or what is in your glass or your vessel. You know, the beauty of this thing, as you said, the mother has the ability, or the mother's body has the ability, to convert food into a human being. And in fact, each one of us have that ability. When we eat something, let's say I eat a fruit, I eat an apple. What is this process of eating? In the process of eating, I'm able to convert a part of that fruit into a human being.
Yes, into a bone, into a blood.
I'm giving it a human life by making it a part of me. And in fact, if you look at it, you have, let's say, some grass which is growing on the ground. This grass has the ability to convert sunlight, water, and the minerals in the ground into some form of edible matter. Might not be edible to you and me, but a cow is able to eat that. And the cow's body has the ability to convert that into another form of food, which probably we call the milk. And that milk, we can take it and make it a human being. So it's a whole process when we say that food do, blood do, and head do. That's what Swami says. The food gets formed into the head. So this food is coming from all these sources, from the ground, from the air, from the sunlight, you know, from the animals, from the plants, and all these sources. So when you talk of food, it is such a comprehensive concept. Probably, you know, the problem with all of us is we know the truths. You know, we've not realized the truth, but we know the truths. You've heard Swami telling that Brahman is this and God is like this. But, you know, that's the problem. So when you say that Bhrigu comes back and says food is God, the first thing is,
some
you know, what an absurd conclusion. But it's actually a very, very profound and brilliant understanding he has come to his father with. Because he's saying that when he's saying food, he's referring to all this. He's referring to sunlight. He's referring to the minerals. He's referring to all these things.
In fact, recently we have concluded the Dasara Yagnam. Swami has detailed as to how this food is so important. Food determines everything. When a question was asked as to what is the use of pouring ghee and so many valuable materials into the fire, when they could have been used to feed somebody, you know, instead of pouring 20 kilograms of ghee into the sacrificial fire there, why don't you use it to feed some poor people? When this question was asked in a discourse, actually, Swami has said, it is as foolish as asking a farmer, why are you wasting a bag of grain onto your land when you can use it to feed 100 people? The farmer will laugh back and reply that this bag of grain will return to me 1,000-fold. Swami said a yagnam is like that. Scientifically, if we see, all the rain that we receive is because of water condensing on cold particulate matter in the atmosphere. Now, this cold particulate matter is created by what? Today, it is being created by exhaust from our vehicles, fumes from our industries, which are not only physically poisonous, noxious, and toxic. What are the kind of vibrations that is there? You know, in a factory, for example, there's a profit motive, there is greed. Greed to get money, you know, at a subtle level also, this is bad particles. And Swami says, instead of that, imagine the rain that is formed because of particles that emanate from a yagna. If you would have seen the flame in the yagna, the smoke that comes is pure white. Because even physically, it's pure smoke, clean smoke, it's non-toxic. It doesn't have carbon monoxide. It's fully burnt, combusted smoke. So physically also, it's clean smoke. And in terms of feelings, it is being charged with samasta loka sukhino bhavantu. May all the beings in all the worlds be happy. May everyone be prosperous. May everyone be peaceful. So that is how it is physically and subtly charged when it converts it into rain. That rain comes and grows the food, and that is how the food is also imbued with those noble intentions and feelings. And when that is consumed, the people's minds change. That is how the connection is. And that is why Swami gave so much importance on sattvic food. In fact, I think the ancients would grow their own food, cook their own food, and eat their own food. Swayampaka, where they would ensure patra shuddhi, that is the cleanliness of the vessel, padartha shuddhi, cleanliness of the food items, right? That is how it was. And because it becomes physically impossible for a person to ensure that the vessel is clean, the thoughts of the person cooking is clean, and the thoughts of the person growing it is good, there is no cheating involved in the sale of it, all this is tough to ensure. That is why, as a shortcut, Swami gives us the food prayer, where he says that before consuming any food, offer it to God so that it gets sanctified by the Lord's touch. And then it comes to us as prasadam. Prasadam is nullified of all the negatives. In fact, it has the positive of God's grace. And such positive food will ensure not only a positive physical body, but also a positive subtle body and a positive mind.
Exactly. And, you know, in many ways, the social differentiation in those days were clearly based on the food habits also. As you said, you know, the ancients, the Brahmins were supposed to cook their own food. They were not allowed to take food from outside or cook by somebody else. Or they had some particular guidelines. It should be cooked by a lady of the house who has, you know, finished her bath and finished her prayers. There's some stipulations like that. But those were not the case when it came to the Kshatriyas or the kingly clans. And the kind of food they ate was different. You know, the non-vegetarian diet which they had was different from these people. So it was clearly when Bhrigu came and said that this is the thing, because the character of a person seems to be defined by the food that they take from the source which is providing the food. You know, the Brahmin behaves the way he behaves because of the food he takes. The Vaishya behaves the way he behaves because of the kind of food he takes. So clearly that this food seems to be having an overbearing effect on characteristics, on personality, on thoughts and actions. So that is why this is so important.
And when we think of these castes, as we say, Brahmin, Kshatriya, as we have repeatedly said, it is not based on one's birth, but based on one's tendencies. When we had this satsang on the value of vegetarianism, I remember we clearly dilated on the fact that, of course, it's not as if eating non-vegetarian has no advantages. There are many advantages at a physical level. But then, from Swami's discourses, it becomes absolutely evident that if at all the top priority in your life is spiritual growth, then non-vegetarianism is a strict no-no. If spiritual development is not a priority, then fine. Then fine, you're having non-vegetarian food. But if you are oriented towards spiritual development, non-vegetarianism is a strict no-no. And as you said, Brahmins, Swami defines a Brahmana as a person who is engaged in the quest of the Brahman. In that sense, Bhrigu is a Brahmana, Varuna is a Brahmana, because they are in the quest of Brahman. So if you are a Brahmana, you can't touch meat and you have to cook your own food, because you have to keep, you know, your mind and your internal space clean without violations of any other kind of vibrations.
It is also coming from the idea that the food has the ability to carry certain amount of vibrations. You know, when you spoke about the Dashara Yajnam, which Swami would very often say that, you know, there are two aspects to food. One is the gross food, which more or less actually gets flushed out of the body. That's what Swami says. You know, the most subtlest form of that food becomes your thoughts. And a little less subtle form of the food is what becomes your nutrients and becomes part of your body. So when Swami would often say that when you're talking about food, we often go by what we see and what we taste, but we forget that part which is subtle and which comes along with the food. And that's why when Swami says you chant Brahmarpanam, or you say that it depends on how that food was gathered or with what intention it was cooked and all that. And when we talk about the Yajnam, Swami would beautifully give that same thing what you said, you know, it becomes the cloud and that cloud becomes the rain. And the water is supposed to be something, one of the elements which has the ability to carry vibrations. And this is one full cycle which Swami says, and how that becomes part of the food. And in fact, later, I think, I don't know whether it comes in the Bhriguvali or in the Taittiriya Upanishad, the relation between fire, water and food is spoken about very much in this Upanishad, where he says, you know, the fire digests water, because you're talking about fire being the Jataragni and water being
Apojyoti.
Right.
The Apojyoti. It's also a kind of fire, they say.
Right. They say that is a fire. This fire digests water. Water is a representation of food. And he says, and that becomes the vital layers inside, which we will come to a little later. But right now, it's that is the point where, you know, we are. And the reaction of Varuna to this response also is similar. He says, you're right. What you've come to understand is quite right. But go back and do tapas.
He says, this is right, nevertheless, but this is not the complete truth. To discover the complete truth, you have to go back and do penance. So it's almost like telling the son, good, you've done a good job, but go, there is so much more to discover. And therefore, Bhrigu now sets off. That Anuvaka ends with Satapo Tapyata Satapas Taptva, which means he's advised to do penance and he goes and does penance. And once again, reiterating that penance does not mean just sitting in a place. Penance is a combination of karma, bhakti and jnana. So that is what Bhrigu does. And then he feels now he has got the key, because he discovers something that is subtler than food. Something which is also the basis for food. Because without that something, even food does not become food. So he feels, oh my God, since this is subtler than food, and God is a very, very subtle being, God is the subtlest among everything, and therefore, if food is gross, if there is something subtler than food, this must be Brahman that I'm in search of. Again, we have no timeline or time span, how much time he does penance. As a slight, you know, detour thought here, Prem, I feel the reason why these timelines are not given is probably because the timelines are not important. It's not important whether you realize this 20 years in your life or 20 days into your life. It does not matter. What matters is that you realize. That is why, you know, possibly when we look and say, Swami, you know, you taught me all this, I have become like this. We look down upon somebody and tell Swami, that person is not even following that much. You know, you should scold him, or how is it that he's getting interview, I'm not getting. How can he receive grace when he's not up to my level also? Because Swami has all the time in the universe. Here, the timeline is not important. What matters is the moment. As long as you're headed towards that direction, that is enough. And that is the reason why I think in Bhrguvalli, they have not given how long he does penance to discover what. But anyway, again, now Bhrgu comes running back to his father and says, Dad, I got it. I know. I know with food, I hit it very close. But the actual answer is subtler than food. Is this the answer? And then here is the, again, apart from the Bhrguvalli, where Bhrgu is telling his father excitedly about his new discovery.
Prano brahmeti vyajanat pranadhyeva khalvimani bhutani jayante pranena jatani jivanti pranam prayanti abhisham vishamti te tadvijnaya punareva varunam pitaram upasasara.
So that's the second part where he comes back and says the same thing. It's almost the same lines, but the word which he uses there instead of annam is pranam. He says, I have understood that pranam is Brahma, prana or pranam, whatever it is. And he says that that is the constant thing and everything comes from that and everything merges back into that. So again, that is the clue. As we said in the beginning, Varuna says that this will be something which never comes and goes. And when he goes and again contemplates, he says that even food has a beginning and end. Food has a change in form, right? You know, you have food which is going from one form to the other. There is food which you can create. You can take certain substances and create something. So that cannot be the basis and that which is Satyam and Anantam.
In fact, if you go back to the example of the mother creating the child, you know, we have many tragic cases where a mother has a stillborn. A child is born without the breath, you know, without life breath. In fact, prana is defined as the vital airs, out of which the life breath, that is what we breathe in through the nose, the first breath that is taken as a baby is born. You know, the baby has to get off the life support system called the mother and start depending on its own life support system. And that is why that first breath and the first wail, in fact, though it seems paradoxical, it is the truth that the first smiles on everyone's face come when the baby wails actually. Because it is not that the baby is crying. They smile because that signifies that the baby has taken its first breath. It is that breath that animates, that brings life, as we say. Otherwise, you know, the same food is not able to create that miracle. It is this life breath that actually creates this miracle that we call as life. And it is this life breath that actually sustains life. You know, you can stay without food for possibly a day or 2 days, a week maybe. We have periods of time where we do upavasa and purposely abstain from food. But this breath, this life breath is something that you can't. You can't hold your breath for more than 2 minutes possibly. And once the life breath goes, though you look, feel, taste, sound the same like how you were before, you know, from an uncle, a father, a mother, a brother or a sister, it becomes the body. And everybody cries saying, Uncle, you left me and went. Mom, you have left me and went. Oh, my brother, you left me and went. And Swami asked the question in his discourses, where has he gone? It is still there. That body is right there in front of you. So you yourself know that the force that is animating it, there is something that is beyond the body. It is not the body. It is not Annamaya. Annamaya is the first sheath, the material world. It is not Annam that is the basis, because the Annam itself has something else as the basis without which you won't consider it as father or mother. There is something that makes it your father. There is something that makes it your mother. And that is pranam, which is defined as life force or the vital airs. Different words in English, because English sadly doesn't have the perfect precise terms as Sanskrit has. But This is what Bhrigu discovers, and he comes and says, yes, pranam is subtler than annam. We can't see it the way we see material, the way we see matter. I can't see this vital air or life force. But it is this life force that is creating the miracle, and it is life force that sustains whatever matter is there. It is life force which gives value to matter. And therefore, Father, I think pranam brahma, I think life is divine, and therefore life has to be protected.
Right. The beauty of this entire process which Bhrigu is going through, it's actually a dual process. You know, he's trying to understand creation. And you talk of creation, you understand, you realize how small a part we all are in that creation. You know, it's like speck of a speck of a speck. It's even that is giving an exaggerated comparison.
Mm.
It's so tiny, trying to understand creation, but his object of investigation is the body. Because every time he's looking at the body, he's, you know, when you talk of food, when you talk of things which you intake and you make part of yourself, when you make part of your thoughts, and now when you're talking about the vital airs, all the time you're trying to understand creation using this tool, which is the human body and human birth or the life forms around you as your subjects of investigation.
Hmm.
And now you look at it again, you talk about this prana. He's not necessarily talking only about the breathing. You know, that is the most obvious prana which we all realize. As you said, the baby in the mother's womb is alive, but it's not breathing necessarily. You know, it's having other life forces which are running around the body, but not necessarily breathing. In fact, you know, it's a very interesting debate in the social circles. When is it, when you do an abortion, you're killing a life? Because, you know, all said and done, the mother is eating the food. That food is becoming a mass of flesh inside the mother's body. But when does it really become another life? That's a very vital question. Because let's say I have some kind of a problem with one of my fingers and the doctor says you have to, you know, amputate it. The process of amputating is not seen as killing a life form, right? It's a part of you which you're just cutting and removing. So similarly, for a mother, when is an abortion just a part of removing something which is a growth inside the body? And when does it become a crime of a murder, or you're killing a life form? And this, they've been breaking their head to see that when is it that the life actually enters that fetus? And I don't think there really any conclusive thought about it. Some people believe that, you know, when the egg is fertilized, it's already become a life form. But that way, if you see, there are so many cells in our body which are actually growing still. So that doesn't mean that they are life forms or they're a different life. So it's a very, very complex thing. When do you differentiate as you are a separate individual and I am a separate individual?
I think that debate, we are not qualified to take up that debate as to when is it that exactly happens. But I'm sure that just by that question, it is a raging debate.
Right. But that is the basis of this thought which, you know, Bhrigu is coming up with. There's something which is animating this jada, which Swami would often refer to that word, no? Jada, which is inert. Something is animating this inertness.
And, you know, as you rightly also said, the physical breathing process is just one of the most easiest to perceive manifestation of this prana, of this life force. Actually, I was reading in yoga, it is called the five vital airs.
Right.
And it is defined as prana, apana, vyana, udana, and samana. So just for technical completeness, prana is the air that we breathe in from above, breathe in and breathe out, you know, from above, which helps in respiration. So that is prana. Apana vayu is the wind referred to from below. This is one which helps in excretory processes and the reproductive processes. This is that is apana vayu. Then comes vyana vayu. Vyana Vayu is involved in, Swami in the Upanishad Vahini says Vyana is to the right. Vyana Vayu, to the right or left, I'm slightly confused now. But Vyana Vayu is supposed to be the one that is involved in circulation, in the distribution of nutrients everywhere. Udana Vayu is the one with which we are speaking. It is the one that helps to animate the throat and through our voice. And Samana is to the center. So center is the one that helps in digestion. So there is prana, pana, vyanodana, samana. So prana, pana is up and down, vyanodana left and right, and samana in the center. So these are the five vital airs. And you know, the yogasanas that we do, if you see at one level, all the asanas are related to one or more of these five vital airs. And that is why, you know, when you go to a yoga practitioner will teach you based on your body requirements, what are the kind of asanas. That's why unlike aerobics, it is not that these are same kind of exercise for all. Of course, doing all the exercises will have some benefit, but based on our own body composition, how we are, because more important than the body is, are these five vital airs. We pick up asanas depending on which we are lacking and which we are having excess of these five vital airs.
You know, the complexity of this one concept of prana shows that, you know, how deep their thinking was. It was not just about this breathing. You know, I think it was our superficial understanding that we always thought that prana was only breathing. Before I went through some of Swami's discourses, I always used to think prana is only the breathing. The breathing stops and you stop living. Mm. But it's not so. Even circulation, if you look at it, you're talking about the heart pumping. Though the heart is pumping liquid, actually it is the, you know, the change in air pressure which is causing that circulation to happen, which is nothing but a form of pushing and pulling of air.
Which is wind,
nothing but that. You know, that is how deep these people have thought about it. It's not just about inhaling and exhaling. It is about the food, the air the food uses for digestion, the air that is used for even speaking and for communicating. You know, all this is involved in a life form to be animated.
And if you see with death, all these five vital airs are gone. All these five are gone. It's not just one of them. Because if it was not a combination of all the five, something at least should have continued.
Right.
But one by one, they go and we can see different stages. You know, when rigor mortis sets in, absolutely, means one by one they leave. And when all the five have left is when, you know, it is said that rigor mortis has set in and that's it.
I mean, you can substitute one or couple of these processes by the other, you know, by medical means. But you cannot do for all of them. And I think at a point where everything comes to a state where it will not regenerate and start on its own, I think that's where medical science gives up.
Exactly. You know, the other day I was discussing with a Sai brother and he was saying that there was a point in time when an operation had to be performed and a heart surgery it was. And when that is, when they do the open heart surgery, the heart is brought to a standstill and then the surgery and repairs are carried out on the heart. And after that, the heart animates, heart is brought back to life by giving a shock or whatever. There was a case, I don't know the details of that. It was actually brought to Swami and, you know, they prayed to Swami there. And Swami sitting here, you know, away from the scene of operation, just said that, you know, this operation is going on. They're praying to me. Yes, now the heart is functioning. You know, as I said, I'm not clear about all the details of this episode, but this is something that is very, very fascinating. Even the greatest of cardiologists cannot give you a guarantee as to once the surgery is done, the heart will start beating back. There is that mysterious, miraculous force which is totally left to what they call as, you know, luck or destiny or fate, but we call it as God. And that is what Bhrigu is discovering here. He's saying that though matter, annamaya kosha, annam can exist, but without this prana animating it, the miracle of life is not possible. And therefore, pranam is Brahma.
Very true. You know, it really shows how much we take for granted. You know, this very single thing of this, you know, child being carried in a mother's womb and a new life being formed. I mean, we have no idea when a growth becomes a life. You know, it is just a growth. You know, we have so many cases where I think even yesterday, if I was reading the news, somebody who had a, you know, 25-30 kg tumor in their stomach, which was operated and taken out.
Kgs.
Right, oh 25 kgs. I mean, it's been suffering for a long. I mean, imagine a lady with a tumor like that, which is about 5-6 kgs. How do you differentiate that growth from another life form
fetus
inside you? When do you know that, you know, it's become a life now, or a life form has entered? And who can determine that? You know, can a doctor come and say that it's a lump of flesh, let me make it alive? No, you can ensure that once the life enters, you can give it the right conditions for it to grow. But can you ensure and can you infuse life into that? Probably that which is directly in control of God. That is the reason why here Bhrigu is saying that that must be God.
Whenever Swami would, you know, elaborate, I don't know the exact words, but Swami would say, Chitrambulu, Vichitrambulu, Trilokya Pavitrambulu, you know, which is Vishnu Deva Charitrambulu. Whenever I used to hear that, you know, I used to think that Swami is describing Vishnu Deva Charitram, meaning the stories of Lord Vishnu. But today I realize that Vishnu Deva Charitrambulu means the miracles of God. This process of the birthing of a child is a divine story, because there are several miracles happening right before our eyes, and just because we are familiar with it, we choose to ignore it, or we don't even choose, we just take it for granted. There are so many miracles that are happening day in and day out right in front of our eyes, which we don't notice because we have taken them for granted. The fact that we are walking, the fact we are breathing, the fact that we are eating something and that is resulting in energy, that is resulting in it becoming our bones and bloods. So many miracles. These are the Vishnu Deva Charitrambulu, I feel, today, you know, as I'm discovering it, I'm getting goosebumps that...
Exactly. I mean, we both have done chemistry and, you know, we have felt the joy of having a chemical reaction being successful, right? You know, when you take reactants and when you do it in the right conditions, when you've done all the procedure perfectly and you get the right result, the joy is like immense. That is nothing but the joy of doership. You know, I have done it. But we don't realize the thousands and thousands of biochemical reactions which happen in our body, which we are doing, you know, the body is doing. But we don't have a sense of doership towards that because we don't realize that they are 1,000,000,000 times greater than what we do physically outside. And that's how much we take things for granted.
So is it any surprise that Bhrigu comes and tells his father that Prana is Brahman? Father is very happy. It's almost like he pats him on his back and says, well done, Bhrigu. But you know what? This is also only the partial truth. You have not got the entire truth. Go back and do penance. And Bhrigu, the sincere seeker that he is, goes back to do penance.
And as you said, you know, we have no clue of how long Bhrigu would have done penance. But at least right now we can say that Bhrigu has to do penance for 1 week. Because the next part which he is going to come and say that this is my understanding, we'll have to really wait for a week. We'll completely run out of time. But you know, what a fascinating journey is this. And when we look at it, we have filled our life with empty achievements, isn't it? You know, we have filled our life with empty entertainments. We spend so many hours of our life with our smartphones, our gadgets and things like that. But here is somebody who can sit in his place. He has not traveled through the skies. He has not gone to the top scientific institutes of the world. But sitting in his place and looking within, somebody is able to come out with such immense knowledge and such immense understanding. You know, it only comes to know that with all that, as we said in the beginning, you know, you have the SIM card, you have the smartphone, you have everything, but we have not put them together and we have not
achieved connectivity
or how we look at it.
So with a prayer at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, that Swami, we are grateful to you for having given us the smartphone, the SIM card and the internet connection. We pray to you that we remain connected, and this connection, as in a smartphone, so too it is in our life, is an internal thing. May we always be connected. May we never lose range. Because when we lose range, it is a problem that we are in a shadow region. You are always there, everywhere. With that prayer, dear Swami, we bring the first part of this discussion to a close. As Brother Prem said, we will be taking it up next week. And dear listeners, we hope that you have enjoyed this. You can write in your thoughts, your feedback, your suggestions to listener@radiosai.org.
Sai Ram, you just heard an episode of our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai at 12:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia Stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 29th October 2015. Dear listeners, we hope you like this program. As always, send us your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and loving Sai Ram from Prashant Nilayam.